Well, I think it starts with the generosity of spirit. So at the end of the day, do not get into hospitality unless you are hospitable. So that's number one.
So if you're grumpy and yeah. so don't like people,
that
not
grumpy
you.
Parisian waiter. Yeah. all people of France are not grumpy.
The Creative Trust is a podcast about the creative process. Amanda Henderson founded Gloss Creative in 2001 and has been making fabulous happen ever since. Gloss Creative and its alumni have mastered the art of creative renewal. Listen as Amanda sits down to explore some of the world's best creative minds. These are their insights and this is their legacy. Welcome to the Creative Trust.
Well, here we are. Bruce, it's been 4 years since you were last on the podcast.
It was a bit different 4 years ago, wasn't it?
What happened? It was. I'm here with Bruce Keeble, who is the founder and director of the Big Group Hospitality Agency, and the incredible Robin Lee, photographer, author, graphic designer, award-winning therapist. And we are here for a very special reason. These two put together this incredible book called By Invitation Only, which I will get them to describe, but we've got it here in the studio and it's really heavy.
It is heavy. I don't know what that cost a ship, but it won't be cheap.
It's going to be a volume that everyone's going to want. I was very excited to start season 5 with you two today. So let's get cracking into it. I want to know, how did this all happen? Did you know each other beforehand and how did it come together?
I kind of stole Robin because she's really Cheeks' friend. So I remember Cheeks came home from a lunch and she met you. I think it was at one of your book launches because Robin, as you've mentioned, is a very accomplished author and creator of books. And she came home and she said, I've met this most amazing woman. And she said, I need to bring new energy into my life and I think this woman should be part of my life. And I'm like, well, call her up and ask her for a coffee. And she said, that's so random. I can't do that. I said, I think you need to. And I think she did, didn't she? And then
yes.
You guys became really good friends. And then, of course, as usual, I'm like, well, I want her as my friend too.
So then we got together over a couple of glasses of champagne and a very nice cheese board, may I say, which has been a bit of a theme of this project. Nice cheese board, a glass of champagne or two. And you said, I want to do a book.
Yeah. And there's reasons for that. We can talk about that. But that's kind of how we met. And it never would have happened without Robin, quite frankly. I would have given up multiple times. But your tenacity and your commitment to this project was extraordinary. So without Robin, there would be no book.
So what are the reasons?
Oh, look, it's very interesting. It sort of started with one emotive sort of part of it, and that was primarily my big fat ego. I felt we'd done so much work for such a long period of time, both within Australia and overseas, but no one really understood what we did as a business.
Story
and
of everyone in the creative world's
yeah.
life.
Mm. Well, and it was sort of resonated during COVID when sort of my family, close friends, you know, business associates sort of knew one genre of what we did, but they didn't really understand the sort of the breadth of the business. So that's sort of where it started. And then part of it is marketing, you know, like, you know, we're running a business, we need to keep telling stories. And I'd found that social media had got to a point where it's just saturated with so much kind of junk. So I'd put a sort of a fatwa on imagery going onto the Big Group sites post-COVID because I felt that what we wanted to do was curate something that was everlasting and was sort of a correct memorial to the work that we do in this country. And then the third sort of more esoteric part of it that's come forward is sort of lifting up and bringing forward so many amazing artists who are in our industry. Because I started looking at the images and going, that's not just Big Group, that's a myriad of people who have come together to make that one image. So I'd see an image in the book that Robbie would present, and behind that I'd see 100 people who had created, made, done something that was part of the process. So that's sort of become the push at the end of the story, is to sort of put Australia on show, show our great eventing talent to the world, and that's how I want to use the book as a forum.
You've used the word the art of Australian hospitality, I've noticed, and I'm like, what is that? How would you describe what Australian hospitality is?
We're really spending a lot of time at Big Group thinking about that at the moment, and have been really over the last 2 years. in business, if you're not unique, you're kind of not in business, right? And to me, the greatest asset that we have as a collective, as a nation, is Australia. You know, the Australianality is so important. So when I look at that in a hospitality sense, and I look at that then in an eventing sense, I put my London hat on and I go to the Connaught and I have a martini at the butler, the Englishness of it. I love it all, you know, little London red cab, and you just can feel it, right? You whiz across on the train, you go to Paris and some snooty French waiter treats you like shit and throws a snail at you. That's France. You go to Italy and it's like buongiornata, you know. And there's this natural cultural peace that comes through the warmth of their hospitality. I believe that we as Australian tourism and Australian hospitality and in the Australian event sector need to harness that and bring it together. Now, we don't all have to say g'day mate and put a witchetty grub on the barbie, but what we do need to do is represent Australia in a coordinated way, from the way we market the country firstly to bring in inbound, and then secondly, when they get here, all these people, we've got to make sure that there's a common thread in the way Australian hospitality looks. So the art of hospitality for us is harnessing those nuances of what Australian hospitality is all about.
So we've talked just a little bit about Australia, but the book to me feels so global. It really does. And the first thing I notice is that you're going into people's private worlds. I think that's what's so sort of interesting about it. You're taking us behind big curtains here into people's lives. Who do you think needs to read this book? Who do you want to read this book?
I would suggest that actually it's really not a who needs, it's a want, because there will be anyone from foodies, there'll be brides-to-be, there'll be people who just love sumptuous interiors and incredible creative design focus, and then there'll be a whole bunch of sticky beaks who are like, what do these parties look like and how are they put together, and having this sneak preview into these lives of great elegance and sophistication.
So what have you learned actually about these special clients? How do they live? How do they celebrate? What's different to everyone else?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Beautiful. I think whether you're a billionaire or, you know, you're the dustman, everyone has a combined joy and love of celebrating special moments with their friends. So, yes, in this book we're looking at events that are, you know, outrageously expensive and all of that. But it's the sentiment, and I think when I look at the journey that I've had and the people that I've met and the places I've been, the common thread is that we all just want to celebrate milestones. So it doesn't matter if you're in the slums of India, they'll make sure that that wedding is so special for those family members that are there. Equally, when you look into that book, we share and celebrate in a very over the top way, but the sentiment is always the same.
And I would actually add to that that in some ways, even though the subtitle of this book is The World's Most Beautiful Parties, actually underpinning that is this sort of great connection of what it means to be a human being, which is connection with other people, community, love, sustenance, inspiration, joy. And I think that's what you do so well. You do all of that. And so on the one hand, it can be seen simply from a visually beautiful, sumptuous book. And on the other hand, there's this underpinning of really important moments in people's lives, turning points in people's lives. So it has a very deep underpinning as well.
And that's if I look back at it, and I suppose, you know, having 35 years of, you know, being in business, I look back on it with such emotion, because it is that deep connection to the people who behind those images are humans. You know, they are people who we know, who we've done the birth of their children, we've done the 12th birthday party, the 13th birthday, the 21st, we've done the engagement party, we've done the wedding, and we're there for the farewell. So we become a sort of a weird constant in people's lives, making memories.
So this volume shows a significant body of work, which I love. Have there been things that, now that you've put it together, that you've seen in hindsight about your 35 years with the big group?
Yeah, in many ways it's interesting because as much as that book is so much about the big group, it's about one small slice of the big group. So I look back on it and I've loved memorializing the work, but what I've realized is I've probably left about 90% out. and the backbone of that business is a large-scale corporate catering company, and you know the events that we do and a lot of the more serious work, I suppose, that we do is not memorialized in that book. But we would have been here for years, Robbie, had we gone down that. So
tomorrow.
That was sort of a look at behind the velvet curtain, which is also the sort of haute couture of what Big Group does. It's the most rarefied work, and it's the stuff where we're working with amazing creatives from around the world. And what that does inside our business, that work, is it trickles down throughout the rest. And so it becomes sort of an ecosystem of creativity and interest and change and learning.
One of the things I've observed about your team whenever we work together or whenever I'm a guest where you've worked with us is the ability to anticipate the guest's needs. It's something that is so rare. How do you train for that? How do you teach that? It's such a definable thing that you guys do. How do you go about making it happen?
Well, I think it starts with the generosity of spirit. So at the end of the day, do not get into hospitality unless you are hospitable. So that's number one.
So if you're grumpy and don't like people, not
grumpy
for you.
Parisian waiter. all people of France are not grumpy. But as an example, then you're in the wrong business. So number one, get in the right lane, I suppose, to start.
You're a natural party person. Let's just call it, Bruce.
What was the rest of the question? I've forgotten that.
How do you make the team do this?
Number one, don't get in hospitality. Number two, it's not necessarily there. It has to be learnt behaviour. It's leading by example. One of the benefits that we've had is the breadth of people that we've met and the brands that we've worked with them. And one of them, a Japanese automotive company, Omotenashi, which is treating a guest as you would in your own home, is part of one of their core fundamentals. So we've worked with that brand for nearly 25 years. So you pick up along the way learnings from others that sort of lift you forward. So that's one of the things that we find really important. As we scale the business, though, if we don't put that into some kind of measurable training mechanism, nothing will grow forward. So we've been working with NIDA, the National Institute for Dramatic Arts, because I believe that being on the theatre is not much different than holding a tray and going out with your drinks as a waiter. You need to put on a performance. So we are using mechanisms like that to train the staff so that they become just parts of the innate way that they work with Big Group.
I love that you're working with NIDA. Yeah. That is just such a great problem-solving thing. Mm.
And it makes sense. It's insane. A choreography, right? It's a dance, and it's a how do you kind of set the scene for the theatre to unfold.
Yeah, and it's been a wonderful collaboration, and that training course is called The Art of Australian Hospitality, and all our staff will go through that eventually so that everyone's on the same founding. And that is about the esoteric part of our business. You can't touch it's intangible, that feeling, but we all know when you walk into your favourite restaurant and they bring you, your whiskey or that glass of champagne, it's like, so it's making people feel special, and that needs to happen each and every day, whether it's a cup of coffee for $5 or a big fancy party like in the book.
So another thing that I absolutely love about you and I think is infused into all of your team is enthusiasm. It's something that I've always been enthusiastic. Even when I was a child, I was over enthusiastic about absolutely everything. And when you're younger, you think, it's a bit of a sappy thing to be enthusiastic. But man, isn't it a great thing in business? So I guess the question I've got to you, what does enthusiasm mean to you?
I suppose I'd slip it straight into curious. I adore the word curious. It's just wonderful. And I sort of am always curious about what's next, what's going to happen. Oh, where did those muffins come from? What are you working on? I'm intrigued. What's Robbie's next book? And I think to be curious is to sort of want to soak up energy and see what's going on out there. So I think that's important. I've had the luxury of sort of waking up happy every day. So, I don't have roadblocks in my way. So that enthusiasm is sort of natural. It's like, when the phone rings, a lot of people don't answer that, when you can't see the number.
Yeah.
I'm like, I love that. That's an opportunity.
It might be the queen asking me to do a party.
Correct. It could be. I mean, often it's a marketing person who I do have to have a strict conversation with about my number. But, that's opportunity, that's curiousness, and that's the enthusiasm to, what's next?
And you can feel it. And I think it's incredible.
And I think actually on that point, there's a I think in creativity, something that's very underrated is almost like a childlike playfulness and fun and curiosity. And with that comes ideas and excitement, and it's very infectious. But also a lot of people grow up and they grow out of that, and you two actually haven't. And I think this is something that's so underrated in the creative discipline fields, and it's so important in what you do, Bruce. And I see your sense of fun coming through in everything you do. But also, as well as that, I imagine you get bored very quickly in that way that kids hate being bored, right? They want to always to be doing new things, and I think that because of that, you are able to make sure that no thing is duplicated and every event is different, and all these parties are so unique, from different from each other. So I think that's a beautiful part of the childlike wonder.
I agree. I think as part of creative process, if you don't have that childlike part of your brain, you're not in business, actually. No.
We're not in our business anyway. Yeah. I mean, yeah. We're very lucky, right, because we get a license to play, and we get a license to play up. We have a license to sort of be a bit naughty. In some of our more corporate accounts, we don't have that license. And, you know, I look at some of my friends who live a corporate life, and slowly they kind of edge and put in health and safety, and there's lots of acronyms and stuff. And so you lose the silliness. So you never want to lose your inner child.
And I do feel when it's harnessed with other people that you work with that maybe have different skills, there's this beautiful balance that you can strike. You know, just that meeting of, you know, creativity and logistics or business or, and I think a lot of people who are in applied creativity like yourselves are also great in business. And we'll get onto that in a minute because that's a whole other thing. But Robin, now onto the book. I want to know two things. How did you come up with the concept of the book, and how much Bruce wrangling did you have to do? Tell us everything.
Well, it's probably true for a lot of visionary genius type personalities that, and Bruce very much is the case. He's a fire hose of ideas, and sometimes all of those ideas come at you thick and fast, and you have to know how to curate, edit, harness, sometimes put to the side, and really try and interpret and curate his vision and his body of work. How did we come up with the structure? That was sort of by accident, because I think Bruce said, I'll give you a hard drive and you can choose the best parties and put some chapters together. And I was like, okay, that sounds great. And then, you know, 2 years later, a million images later, looking
and
through.
And she's not making that up. It was like, just under a million images.
It was transparencies. It was negatives. It was proof sheets. It was hard drives. It was CDs. It was DVDs. It was links. It
90s,
was
2000, 2010.
Yeah, and then we chose the images and then we found the hard drive. So it was like this process that just unfolded over a period of time, and within that was the structure that he came with. It wasn't going to work because we realised that we needed a structure that was really based around themes, and so within that everything grew. So it was like putting the plots of the garden together and then seeding them, and then it all started to fall into place.
The very difficult thing, I think, for Robin was that we didn't have full capsules of the events. So many of the events had been recorded by the client from the perspective of, if it was a wedding, here's the bride, here's the family. So a lot of personal images, versus had we been shooting to do an interiors book on events for 35 years, we would have been able to caption them much better. So it was very hard from the point of view of the number of photographers and the different light images and the term of time.
It does take a very special eye to curate both words, images, and graphics. I'm blown away with someone who has all of those three skill sets. I don't know of anyone else who has all of those skill sets. So I'm imagining that all of your pre-work has led to this in some way. How did you get so smart?
I've done a lot of exhibition work, and I've also directed a lot of TV commercials and moving pictures. So I'm really interested in storytelling through a visual lens, but also I guess I feel an affinity with you two in that, in curious about life. So I've often felt like the image falls short of telling the full story, and that with the words coming out of the one brain, you can create a bit of a synergy or a coherency with that combination. The problem for me is because I've been doing photography since I was 15, I'm now 54. For me, the photography is innate, it's intuitive, it's instinctive, it's feeling above all else. So going in and a sensory experience of what I'm shooting. And the writing is still very difficult. I've been doing it for 10 years now, but I still find it takes that other part of the brain and it's very challenging. But with each project, I'm trying to bring more of all of those other aspects, so the intuition, the instinct and the emotion into the text and marry the two in a more cohesive way than what I've done in the past.
Well, it certainly looks like that in the book. When I look at your pages and the way that you've brought all those disparate threads together, it does seem like an incredible sort of mood board, a book of incredible mood boards as well. Is that something I'm just putting a spin on?
I think you're absolutely right, Amanda, and I think that when you think of the word mood, what is mood? How do you create mood? And Bruce is the master of this, so he understands that every sense has to be harnessed and finessed and even stimulated in the best possible way. And I think, for example, in this book you'll see a woman in like a turmeric-toned silk gown walking through long grass in a rural estate next to an image of a tall glass with a golden cocktail with a smither of, hand-picked garden thyme and then some edible flowers. And then you'll see another image where you just glimpse through to a gorgeous big tent which is on the most perfect grass that you just want to throw your shoes off. So it's thinking about all of those different senses and how to stimulate them. What does silk feel against the skin? What does it taste like to have that cocktail? What does it feel like to have your shoes or your feet in a really sumptuous, lush carpet or a carpet of grass? Mm. So I think that this is where what they do is so masterful, and I think that really comes through in the images in the book.
You're obviously a colour master as well. Each of those, when I look at the book, each page is soaked with an underlying mood of colour as well, and you can see that coming through. Some of the other stuff I've just really enjoyed, and kind of a question for you, Bruce. I noticed you've put recipes through the book. Am I going to better do them at home?
Well, you are. Lisa, who you well know has put all those recipes together. So, yeah, we haven't done them to trick you up. I was a bit anti putting recipes in the book. Robbie was very pro putting them in. The interesting thing about the category of that book is it's very difficult because where does it go? It's not a cookbook. It's not necessarily interiors book. And a bit like the world of events, like our world of temporary, we sort of outlier, right? We're architects of experience, not architects of buildings. So people have trouble understanding what we do. And I suppose that goes back to the original theory. I wanted people to see all these talented people who create these environments, albeit they only last for 24 hours, but they sometimes take 12 months to coordinate and put together.
Mm. So did you do a separate shoot for the food?
Yes, we did. Yeah, we had to. We had to reshoot.
That would have been delicious.
Yeah. It was. It was a seriously good after party there.
Well, that was the hard thing for Robbie because she's working with maybe 100 other photographers' images. Then she has to use some of hers and then trying to bring them together so that a piece of work, like a beautiful image of one of your pieces in NAB, which is so beautiful. It's just one image and it's from the early 2000s, but then matching that up with everything else, that's the genius of Robin.
You can feel it in the book. It's incredible. What is it that you love so much about creating books? Because this is the bit where we say that you've written 19 books. The book you created last year is a bestseller. It's on the number one on Amazon, The Creative Life. And you've interviewed some stellar people, JJ Martin, Anne McGuinness. You've been around the world photographing celebrities and writing books for a very long time. And as Bruce says, accomplished comes to mind. What is it that you love about this?
Well, I think you've sort of answered your own question there, Amanda, because when you think of that process, like going around the world, interviewing the most fascinating visionary creatives and stepping into their homes and capturing what they do and understanding, for me, fundamentally the genesis of the creative spirit, where that comes from and why when you understand the why, why do you need to do what you do, Bruce? Why do you need to do what you do? Understanding and unpicking that question for me is endlessly fascinating, and it often leads to insights into a person and into a mind and into a world that they've created that speaks to the human spirit.
But Robbie, also too, I think you're a little secret voyeur like I am. You know, like what we both do, and I don't think we've probably ever stopped and thought about this, but we get the privilege to jump into someone else's world, into their lives. So that's into their fashion, that's into their design, that's into their palazzo, that's into their car. You see, once you see how people live, then you can see the pathway of what either they need, you know, from an eventing point of view, or for you, or from the emotional intent of what they need as a book. So yeah, it is fascinating. I think we're both voyeurs, Rob.
I think we're voyeurs, but I think we're lovers of fun too.
Oh yeah, we're definitely.
And I think the fun part, it's like getting on the plane and going and doing some of these things is endlessly
what's not to love.
Fun.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Here we are. Pasadena, yeah.
I know. Having a nice time doing this wonderful shoot. I mean, really, I couldn't think of a better day.
So what have through this process, what have you observed about the big group?
Gosh. Bruce is covering his eyes.
I'm glad this is audio.
There's a lot that I can't say.
I'm crying to get out the door.
I think that the big group has this, and back to this sort of childhood thing, I think as children we're all looking for stimulation and excitement and learning. And I see what they do is all about providing experiences for people that they can't replicate at any other time, in any other setting. It's unique and it's joyful and it's sometimes wild and sometimes kind of crazy in the most creative, wonderful way. So it's the antidote to boredom. And it's really stopping and, as Bruce was saying earlier, celebrating these very important moments in people's lives.
I agree. I think often, you know, early on in my career, I was like, oh, what I do is a little bit vacuous. And then after a while, I thought, no, we're in that, like, that moment where a lot of things have come together for families and we're helping them to celebrate a milestone. Mm. And I guess bringing that joy to people's lives is the colour. You know, that everybody loves. Mm.
And a lot of it's really unforgettable. Important. I mean, these parties, you step into one, you'll never forget it. And they live on in people's lives and people talk about them at the end of their lives. Is you can't, you can't forget what it was like to sit on an elephant going into a palace in Rajasthan and eat an 8-course feast wearing a turban. Like, it's just like beyond imagination for
There's
most people.
Probably some things in that are very unwoke, but at the time it was fabulous.
It was great. But it's true, and we have that same feeling where, you know, some of the marquees that we created in 2006, people will come up and go, I remember when you created that French thing, da da da, and I'm like, wow, that was 18 years ago.
But that's the thing about your work. It was there for 4 days. You know, when that image that is in the book sits next to one by Jos Bakker, which was also at least maybe 15, 20 years ago. And that's the genius of both your work, because as brutalist as that left-hand image is that Jos has put in there, as refined and modern, but, you know, that interior of Versailles that you created is extraordinary. So I look at that through your eyes of that creativity, and that's one layer. And then now I'm starting to look at the second layer. Who's the guy who made the steel? Who's the person that printed all of that Versailles to match that up? Mm. That artist that you brought in with that incredible light. So then there's this backstory of all these other people who are the backbone of the events industry. So yes, it's just parties and it is a bit vacuous, but there is a massive event economy there that is supporting a lot of people who just work and do great jobs.
I guess in business, I've watched you and observed with, I guess, a little bit of wonder how you take your business every 5 or 10 years to the next level. For example, your evolution into Sydney. You've done something like that every 10 years, whether it's opening new venues. There's this continual evolution. And obviously coming out of COVID, that was obviously, we have to mention that at some point because we are the event industry in Melbourne. What's your plan? You know, is the business plan or just evolving or world domination? What are we going for, Bruce?
Well, it's all about what's scalable and what's not, which, you know, you have sort of referenced. And that's a really important thing in businesses like ours because it's very nuanced, it's very personal. So there's part of the big group that is that. And I suppose by invitation only, really pays homage to that work. That work, that personalization is very hard to scale. The sort of the 90% of our business, which is the backbone of it, is big business, major eventing, corporate accounts. So that's the part that we are pushing forward with. And yes, I've always worked in 5-year sort of cycles. Mm. And I've always run just by my gut, which is rather large. And it sort of tells me what to do. And obviously COVID was survive. That's all I wanted to do, was to survive and thrive. So I just said to the team, we will survive and then we're going to thrive. And so part of that is why we made the decision to move to New South Wales and open, you know, multiple businesses there over these last couple of years. And then once we got that, my next plan is basically to scale what we can scale out, because I'm at a point of time from an age perspective and from the executive team at Big Group is we're ready to move to the next step. So we've always been very cautious about how we grew, because organically we never took in big funding from anyone. We always only did it with what cash we could, and that's the way we've been able to protect our decision making and stay fluid and flexible and creative in our decisions. So yeah,
have some control.
Control's very important.
It is. And a part of the last 5 years is I've seen you really step up in terms of leadership within the event industry. No one in Melbourne will forget your beautiful car chats and beyond about what the industry needed at the time. And I'd love to know your thoughts about how you think the Melbourne industry now can move into the future. Like, what do you think needs to happen?
A lot, unfortunately. I think we're in a very – I think we're in a crisis mode, actually, is where I'm sort of at. So I suppose I'm using the 35 years and I'm using the story of the book to very much push forward about the Australian event economy and very much about Victoria, because if we want to maintain this reputation as Victoria as the major events capital of Australia, we need to do quite a lot. And part of that is, I think, a coming together of the industry. I think at the moment many of the major events and some of the festivals – actually competing on like for like. I think we are not playing hard enough into the cards that make us unique. And just Victoria alone, if you look at the infrastructure and the way it's built, you can stay in a hotel and walk to the Australian Open. You can get a tram down to F1 or straight out to racing. There's nowhere in the world where that infrastructure happens in the same way. So for us to hold those majors is very unique. So we need to market that, and, you know, businesses or business government agencies like Visit Victoria are doing a brilliant job of that, but we can't stop. So I see our role as making sure, as you know, once we get people here, we need to really lift up, because AI, food mobility, the changes in tech, there is so much coming. And what I would like to see for Victoria is that our events industry is way advanced to the rest of the world, and we are training people in Victoria in events and sending them globally.
How are we going to do this?
We are going to, Amanda, start getting close to government. I don't care which one it is. I really don't. It doesn't make
Bruce
any difference
Fikuyon.
To me. No, Bruce is not going into politics. But I've understood post-COVID that if you don't have a relationship with government, if you don't have a relationship with the decision makers, you can't import change. So it's very emotionally important to me that I leave this industry in better shape than when I found it. That's not to say it was in a bad shape. It was in a great shape, actually, when we came into business. But we need to now be really lifting up young caterers and young event producers and designers and stylists. And I'm not seeing enough in the competitive landscape at the moment. So, in fact, I want to see more people doing great things, and I'd like us to be doing more unique things in the event industry. We should be trialling food mobility here in Victoria to prove to the rest of the world that we can serve 10,000 people a beer in 10 minutes.
It is interesting, the whole thing of generational change and generational passover of knowledge and that sort of thing. And you have really mentored generations of creatives, which you can see in here. It's really beautiful, and I feel the same way when you see, you know, like, say, Steph D'Alberto, you know, my greatest gift to you.
greatest gift ever. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I think about more recently, someone was talking about the other day, we were talking about trajectory or status. And I love this idea. And I remember hearing you on business interview on an economic small business TV with Koshy or someone like that. And you were interviewing a young guy and he said, "Oh, but I'm just a young person trying this out." And you were like, "No, never think young and good looking and fabulous is bad. And I was like, that is amazing, because in people's career, I love it when you see someone who has the knowledge and the skill and they're at what I call bloom phase, and their trajectory is so powerful when they can do the job of an older, experienced person. It's a beautiful moment when they're just transitioning to that trajectory to someone who's has status. I think it's a magical time. So for you, is it trajectory or status or both?
Oh, I'm confused. It's so long. look, the one thing about me is I'm not probably naturally creative, but what I do understand is the creative process and intent. So if you look at it as a pendulum going back and forth, I sort of sit at the top. I'm not going to cut my ear off. I'm not like Van Gogh. I'm not like...
We're so grateful.
You and Yost are a bit more ear cutter offery, because you come up with the new idea, and that's a really important part of creativity. You go to the other end of the pendulum and you're just doing Excel spreadsheets, and that's not good. So I sit right in the middle. So that being able to understand that mind and what that talent needs is part of the way we orchestrate our creatives.
And what about you, trajectory or status?
I don't really know either, actually. I suppose when I think about just what you were saying in the question earlier, or what you were referring to, this idea that the young people can bring so much, and I believe in that. And some of the people that I work with often are young, very talented people. I'm of the view, and I've seen you do this with your staff as well, Bruce, that you know, late teens and 20s is the time to be an apprentice in the world that you want to exist in, and to look for the right mentors and to ask for help from those mentors. And I remember actually in your introduction, you wrote so beautifully about the mentors that you had at that time and how important they were. And I think that now, as sort of elders in the industry, and you know, you guys are the masters of what you do, you have a role to do the same for very young, talented people. And I think sometimes those young, talented people want to fast track it, but to sort of honour the fact that you are an apprentice until you turn 30, and just thinking of it that way, rather than I'm not going to go and do that job because that's below me. It's like, do the work, wax on, wax off. You know, what was his name, Mr. Miyagi or something? Like, be the apprentice, learn. Eventually you'll become a master.
And I do agree that 20s to 30s really sets you up for 30 to 40. You know, if you're not doing too much in your 20s, then you're probably not doing too much in your 30s either.
Absolutely.
In a way. So yeah. I definitely agree with that one. So the Big Group has flourished for over 30 years. What do you think you've got right, and what do you think that you continue to get right?
I think one of the things that we do really well is put people in the right spot, you know, and it is a sort of a jigsaw puzzle of human minds, emotions. But I think once you find someone who's really talented at something, they need to be in their lane way, and you need to try to strip away all the things that don't make them run fast. So I think once you get that lined up, and that's whether it's someone who's really good at operations and they're just, you know, so OCD, they line everything up, which is wonderful.
Love that.
The beauty of understanding that, you know, a tomato is like a musical note. There's 5,000 billion ways to use that tomato, so it's never a sort of stagnant object. So all of that sort of leads into getting the right people in the right spot. So I think we've done that really well, because it's all about people. And then what's the next part of the question?
What do you continue to get right? Apart from the chicken sandwiches. yeah.
Look, the food, all the real components, they're super important, right? Lining all that stuff. For me, it's always the more esoteric stuff. I mean, what scared me a lot about moving into the New South Wales market and so quickly, I mean, we've built out nearly 8 venues up there, and I think there's 600 or 700 staff on the ground. So that, for me, frightens me. So building culture, not building sandwiches, that's easy. You won't make the right sandwich unless you have the right culture. And I left the other day. We did a big event last week, and all of a sudden someone puts, I don't know, ABBA Dancing Queen or something, and then I see 60 of our staff all on the podiums and the stage with funny hats on, blowing bubbles and dancing at 11 o'clock at night. And I thought, oh, my God, this is amazing. They've built their own culture. We've given them the license to play,
right,
but that's alive and really well.
I love that. One of the other things I've observed is that I see you and Chica doing work and life so very well. You both seem to have fun with it, and it doesn't appear that you have some ridiculous, you know, slavish work ethic that you're bound to, or do you just make it look easy?
Well, don't believe everything on Instagram. But that said, look, we're happy and we've been having fun together for 35 years. And whilst now we do slightly different things, I mean, there's not a day that goes past where I don't know everything that's going on in Cheeks's business world and vice versa with the big group world. And yeah, we have fun and we take time to, you know, travel and see things and do things together. This weekend we were both bloody so exhausted. You know, we left on Friday.
It was a big week last week.
It was a massive week and we were supposed to go to a dinner on Saturday, and we are not those people who cancel, but we cancelled. And I just said, we need to have our energy. I need to just cook and we just need to, you know, regroup so that we're right. So it's bouncing and bouncing up. We're also at a very luxurious stage in life, as you well know from our Malvern Central days when the kids were young. We are through that phase. I'm not running around picking up four kids and going to thing. So there's a selfishness about the fact that our children are growing up and one lives in London and the other in Los Angeles. So it takes that other pressure off. So we do have the ability to focus on ourselves when we need to and our businesses.
It's a great time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fun.
So, Robin, we talked a little bit about the things that you can scale and the things that you can't scale. When I think about your work, I think, you know, what you do on the pages is so artistic and creative, and there's that sort of unscalable magic of you. But talk to me about how you distribute books. So obviously you want scalability there. I do understand that books are hard to distribute. How do you go about it? I mean, obviously you're doing pretty well in terms of, you know, the world. You've certainly made a name for yourself. Talk to us about the business of creating and distributing books.
Well, fortunately, most of the time I don't have to get too involved with the distribution because I work with two publishers, one being Asselin and one Thames and Hudson. In this particular project, we did work directly with a distributor, Perabo, actually, should anyone need to stock the book, you know where to go. They do a lot of that legwork. So it is important to have a distributor that either distributes internationally or has relationships with other distribution networks overseas. And I think that's a key part. But also a key part of distribution is getting the word out. And you've got someone like Bruce and Chica who have, you know, literally a million and something followers between their various social networks. And it's a great way to get the word out. So the people who love these sorts of projects, that's design, food, parties, and this private world, even know the book exists. So that's key.
What has you been your most interesting day at work ever?
Do you want to start, Bruce?
No, I asked you.
I'll start. Okay. Yep. Boom, today. Okay.
Today.
Fantastic. Because every day is great, and how fun to start today with coffee and like little snacky things that I'm trying not to munch on mic. And how fun is this? And then I've got multiple appointments till 6 o'clock tonight, all different, all fun. Every day.
Fantastic.
Every day is different for you. It's good. My most interesting day ever was I lived in New York for 5 years and I couldn't get a job to save myself when I first got there. It was on the end of the back of the economic downturn. And so that's when I started writing and shooting for the first time. One of the first projects was at Jackson Pollock's house, which is now a museum on the South Fork of Long Island, about 5 or 6 Ks out of East Hampton. And taking photographs in Jackson and his wife Lee Krasner's pantry led me to the understanding that they were foodies by looking at all their crayfish pots and Le Creuset everything, and that led me to discovering Lee and Jackson's handwritten recipes, which led to a best-selling book. So it was that day, just being curious, back to this curiosity, and being a foodie myself and going, oh, I'm just going to take photos of their pots and pans and their cut glass collection and their funny little, you know, ceramic jugs, because I just love that. And that all leads to, but hang on, asking questions. But who would have been at their dinner parties? What would have they served? Mm-hmm. And then asking the director those questions, and then these recipe books came out, and a lot of recipes were stuffed into the back of those recipe books, handwritten at dinner parties that attended with artists. And it led to this whole discovery around Jackson Pollock beyond the iconic genius of expressionism.
Canberra buying a painting.
Into Jackson Pollock, the apple pie maker, Jackson, the one who loved his garden, who used to lie in the grass by his garden after he'd done his gardening, and he loved his vegetables passionately. Like this,
or his
all
very
this
beautiful
other side.
Bread recipe, which I now have hanging on my wall.
You do, yeah. So that was possibly one of the most interesting days of shooting and work I'd ever done, yeah.
And you can see these, just what you've described, but there are hundreds of days here. Interesting, like you're saying, it's hundreds of interesting days in here as well that feed you and, you know, help you to grow your love of what and curiosity of what the next, I guess, subject matter might be. And it's always joyful to go down those rabbit paths because you never know where they're going to take you.
That's absolutely right.
As well. What are the intangible, I'll just say ego aside, what are the intangible things that you love about your work?
I think it's the connections with other creative people and therefore the trying to understand how they work and where they come from and why that's all important leads me, I suppose, to understanding myself better as a creative person too and what I need. You know, when I had young kids and I put my creativity to the side to a certain extent, I knew the detrimental effect that had on me and my mental health. And so understanding that I need to do it and why I need to do it, and then connecting with other people who need the same, I find just wonderful. And it's an intangible benefit and it's a very meaningful benefit.
That must be very satisfying when you work that out.
Very satisfying. Yeah. And then you know what gas you need in your tank. Don't put the diesel in when you need the unleaded. It's the same. You know, we all need to understand ourselves and how do we run best. And that's how I run best, is by being creative as often as possible.
And what are the intangibles for you, Bruce?
Of this project? I suppose for me, it's a bit like the eventing, right? I love the process of it all going together. But when that goes out into the world, that's the bit I don't like as much.
You're on to the next.
It's the same as with the events. I love the process of everything, discovery and building and creating and mixing. I love it when it's that 5 p.m. sort of moment. The light is just perfect and that room is amazing. And then the bloody guests come in and ruin it all. So it's a bit the same with the book. I'm like, are people going to touch that book and put chicken fingers on it? Yeah. Like, can't we just leave them all in a box somewhere and it's done? So, yes, so I love the process and the joy that I had over the last two and a half years with Robbie, you know, remembering and going down the journey of what was pretty much kind of mine and Chica's life was highly emotive.
All right. So a couple of quick things I want to know. Bruce, who gets invited and why?
In the old days, you got invited because you were fabulous. Now you get invited because a team of PR and comms people put an ROI on your head. So they basically decide who's got the most social media reach, who's going to get a photo taken of them, and I find it very boring. So it doesn't make for a great group of people, and, you know, budget is one thing, but if you don't have the great people in the room, it's a problem. So we value too much social reach over creativity, diversity, craziness, you know, fun. You know, you need funsters at a party.
It is interesting, you know, when I look back at, say, the photograph of Robert Buckingham and Lisa Van Handel
Beautiful.
Sitting in the Bill Henson soaked green silk, and I think about the people that were there, they really honoured the party in a way. You know, sometimes you can have an event now, people come in, take a photo, and leave.
Correct. So what?
It's business.
Yeah. Well, these events used to be private, very seminal kind of moments for people. They, you know, are more of our brand work and the luxury sector, and to a certain degree, some of the corporate stuff and major eventing is. There's a lot riding on that event, right? So it's not just there for fun, but we've almost got the pendulum gone a little bit too far the other way, where we have forgotten the fun factor.
So, Robin, what do you think even though you're not in big group, what do you think makes a great guest? Like, how do you be a good guest?
Well, actually, I'm going to take my cues from Bruce in this, because in the introduction, he took his cues from his mother, who said, "Oh, it's always better to be overdressed than underdressed." And he also says, if you're not going to come to a party and be, you know, involved in conversation and bring energy and bring enthusiasm, you're almost better off not to go. And I echo that. I suppose I love entertaining myself, and I love bringing people together. And the people that bring that will always be invited back. And you notice that when people bring that energy, and I think it's key.
That's another intangible, isn't it, bringing that energy and that, as you said, the sense of generosity.
You need to be on for your host.
You do. Like,
that's your obligation as a guest.
Off to-nighter for everyone.
Correct.
So, Bruce, what makes a great client, and how can I be a good client?
I think knowing who you are is a really important thing across the board in life. But being a great client is actually knowing once your personal style, knowing the cuisine that really fits you and your lifestyle, knowing the environment and the design. So I think when people are clear, it's really great, because all we are doing then for them is sort of taking them on this journey of creating something better than perhaps they could have themselves. So I think being clear in your objectives is really important. Mm-hmm. Hard when it's a personal brand. When we're dealing with a corporate brand, you know, there's a mission statement and values, and we know how to build that because we know who that brand is. Often people don't know themselves, and therefore their personal brand is slightly off.
It is interesting it's amazing when you work with a client who knows what they want. And you and I have worked for families who really know what they want. Yeah. And it's a really pleasant process, isn't it?
Yeah. It changes the whole dynamic. Equally, it's like everything. When people are in business and they understand process, it makes it a lot easier. Often people we work with have never had a party or an event before. So it's like when I've got to build a house, it's new news, right? So everything seems foreign to me. So our role is to sort of take people through that journey to the best outcome.
And to let them know what the process is.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time doing that as well, and I'm sure
you're sort
you
of training them.
Yes, I agree. So we have this thing at the Creative Trust podcast, which is a question, and it's, are you back of house or front of house? Robin, what are you?
I think I'm back of house because I'm often behind the lens. But in saying that, even as a photographer, I shoot both back and front of house, and I love them equally. So I'm sitting on the fence.
You're sitting on the fence. And I'm assuming, Bruce, nothing's changed in the last 4 years for you. You are front of house.
Well, you know what? They have actually changed. I've sort of learned I'm more of an introvert than an extrovert, and maybe that's as I age, but I'm much more back of house. I would have always said I was probably front of house to sort of be showing up to say, yeah, that's me in front of the party. But I think I prefer the voyeur in me, watching, creating, seeing the magic happen, but then exiting stage left.
I love that. Thank you so much for your time today. The book is incredible. I can't wait to scurry on out to read it now. Congratulations. You've done an amazing job, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you. Thanks. Fun. And thank you for all your beautiful work that's in there too. It's incredible. And when you look at how timeless that gloss work is, it's so amazing.
I can't wait to read indeed. About it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to send one to my mum.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.